So the Buddha said that if you could stay mindful for 7 days, you would be there. There's one slight, and some, he was asked, you know, would it be, you know, I think Ananda asked him, you know, would it be 1 month, 6 weeks, 1 year, 7 years? And the Buddha said, no, 7 days. But there's a little problem with this. I think you know, as soon as you sit down, mindful for 7 days? Okay, so now you got the drift here. But you actually were here long enough. It's just that, you know, took a little more than estimated, you know. It's called the world calling. From this silence so well constructed, I wander off into tomorrow, bending like a willow, trying to touch a world unhatched. This impossible of my imagination. I am the intimacy of faith, which is buried beneath the wounds of all my stories. Sometimes everything has to be studied, knowing somehow this sitting here is not enough. This knowing, this fierce walking like pilgrims through the darkness, knowing we've traveled inside everyone. Feeling the grief, the joys, I want to know. No more traveling on the wings of fear and hope, but to sit by the fire of living, no longer dying to what could have been or even what will be, but finding my place in the things that are. Some mystery, some grace, some bit of mercy miraculously lived. So let this listening, somewhere beneath the granite shelves of the earth, where the sweet waters lie in wait, to be tapped to give life back to itself. This basic goodness, this first step home, gives you back to yourself. The heart flowing with each encounter, a mind pliable, moving like the sweet stream from the deep down listening. I am awake. As the world calls in its pungent need to change me, I move into it with it. So tonight, I want to do, you know, I was thinking, I'm teaching the whole tonight, you know, because these things are really, they're so important and functional. And I thought, oh, maybe tonight I'd do something different. But I think I want to do a regular old get off it Dharma talk, you know. And so it had, you know, there are five kind of pieces I want to kind of explore with you. And it's basically, you know, a lot of it I've talked about, but I want to do it again. And one is impermanence, one is the body, one is views and opinions, identity, this holding on to self, and this simple awareness. So those are the kind of five things I want to bridge. And when I get to the awareness, I like this thing, loving awareness. So I'll get to how this all works on some level. So first, symptoms of inner peace. A tendency to think and act spontaneous rather than based on past experience. An unmistakable ability to enjoy each moment. A loss of interest in judging others. A loss in interest of judging oneself. a loss of interest in interpreting the actions of others, a loss of interest in conflict, a loss of the ability to worry, frequent overwhelming episodes of appreciation, contented feelings of connectedness with others and nature, frequent bouts of smiling, an increased tendency to let things happen rather than to make them happen, an increased receptivity to the love extended by others, as well as the uncontrollable urge to extend it. That's symptoms. So, these first two, I've talked about quite a bit in some sense the impermanence, but you know, you can never talk about it enough because, you know, from birth, this whole process of impermanence actually is our capacity to look at, ultimately, to look at dying. And so it's not a light subject in that way, and yet, the Buddha encouraged, if you can really get this, that it is one of the greatest happinesses, because you have the power, that the symptoms there, you have the power to let go, you know, anything that comes up, you know it's nature, and so there is this kind of open, free heart, mind that lets things kind of come and take their own, arisings and passings away. So there's not, you know, one of the things is that we have a tendency to get caught in the thing, I think you know the word drama, you know? And a lot of times it's quite debilitating on some level. But I think there's also the possibility of understanding that it's true. And sometimes it feels kind of permanent, you know. But in its nature, it is impermanent. And when it's impermanent, there is, some capacity to recognize that even the big drama, ultimately, when, in a sense, we take the hooks off of it, then it actually becomes something else, you know. So the drama actually turns. I love that bumper sticker I talked about, you know, Dharma instead of drama, but I'm talking here about drama that turns to Dharma. That it actually will transform itself, you know. And it takes these practices. It takes this repetition of being able to, a lot of the sitting here. Probably one of the greatest teachings is this. You know, I always thought, well, what is it that, you know, is obvious from one level, and subtle and freeing on another, you know. So don't worry, you'll keep playing with this one, you know, right up to enough words. So I wanted to kind of cross that piece because I think it's so, if you're looking at the whole of these practices, this is an imperative piece that, all these things need to be realized and understood. The second piece is really about body, you know. And I've spoken a lot about it here, but again, you know, the training itself is you're going to go out there in the big bad world, and you have a fabulous tool, you know, and the tool is actually remembering. And remembering what? We're remembering to simply, what is it that's noticed? And traditionally, it may be the breath, but it may be something in the body. And immediately, once you are aware of that, you know, there is a space, like thoughts, oh my gosh, you know, they just move so fast and we attach to them so easily. So if there's a little space in there, like, oh, I just felt this and I connected to my body and then I had space between that and maybe the reactivity or the story that we were just going to jump on the train of association and, you know, go down the road. So it's kind of a very important piece here to keep training your mind, just like the recognition of all things in permanence. It's also the practice of putting the mind, in a sense, kind of, if I can use the word, kind of at rest in the body, you know. And you will keep working this, you know, and this is not a, you know, instant thing, I must say. But just like the impermanence brings a sense of space and freedom, as the body becomes, in a sense, it becomes the, you know, the embodiment becomes the teacher, you know. And it doesn't mean that somehow it's about indulging, because you can, but it's just simply being able to kind of bring the attention back to it, you know, and say, oh, hi, I know you. Should we hang out together a little here, you know? And when you sit in the morning, you'll be hanging out with that. So why not kind of, as I said, it's about remembering during the day to, you know. I had this thing, I was going down to the Bay Area to teach. Or maybe it was one of my great meetings at Spirit Rock. Drive me bonkers. And I stopped in Fairfield, and I don't know, some convenience store or something like that, and locked my car, and I went in. And I left, you know, being a country boy, I left my iPhone on the dash, you know. And so somebody came along and broke the window and took the iPhone. Of course, you know, with the technology these days, it's like your whole life was just, you know, exposed to total hacking, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting, because then I kind of went, what, you know, and my first reaction was a normal, I think it's called panic. You know? And you know what I started doing? And then, oh, I don't know, people from the convenience stores, everything, they'd come out already. And so I started walking back and forth behind my car. And I realized I was completely out of my gourd. I was like, I was somewhere up in the ionosphere, you know? And I remembered. And so I stomped my feet. And I sit there, and I just stomped my feet, and I stomped them over and over until I came back, you know? And it was suddenly, oh, it's okay. You're going to work this out, you know? And it's amazing. You can go on, if you have Find My iPhone or something like that, and you can kind of erase all the stuff on it, you know? It was kind of interesting how... that's maybe the good side of technology. So anyway, they have the iPhone. It went who knows where, you know? And I erased all the info off of it. But it wasn't that the point, because I was able to do that. I didn't know that at the time. You know, all I knew was the thing was gone and it had all my info from banks to, you know, the whole shebang, you know. So I rightfully panicked. You know? But I also, you know, it took me a few, it took a few minutes before I went, oh, wait, now, get back here. You know? You're going to make up some stories about, you know, how suddenly your bank accounts will all be empty and, you know, everything will be, you know, you will be a homeless person. And you know. We can tell a lot of good stories that way. And that's, you know, that's the thing. That's that thing about the drama and the ability to come back. And it was actually a great teaching. The stomp, I could do that. Now, whenever I kind of get too far out there, I stomp my feet. You know, it's like, oh, okay, I'm here. I know I'm here, you know. So you might want to try it sometime when you panic, you know. I hope you don't, but, you know, oh, no, I'm not going to say it, but things happen, okay. You know the word before it, you know. So we have, these are things you actually, you know, we've talked about, and but I just want to, again, remind you, you know. The next one we haven't talked so much about, and a little bit, but it's really, this third one is about opinions and views, you know. And they are, you know, as it goes. You know, Ajahn Chah? Yes, that's right. You know, he was asked, you know, what is it that kind of separates people? And, you know, I mean, there's some problem like that. And his response was simply, you know, that because of opinions and views, you know, religion, country, all of it is all of it is that the separating out has to do with views and opinions. So in a way, part of this kind of waking up is, first of all, to understand that views and opinions are the thing that separate us from each other, you know, that whether it's cultural, racial, you know, this is the thing that separates. This is from the Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh. Do not be bound to any doctrine, theory, or ideology, even Buddhist. All systems are guiding means. They are not absolute truths. Do not think that the knowledge you possess is changeless, absolute truth. Avoid being narrow-minded and bound by present views. Non-attachment from views to be able to receive others' views. Renounce fanaticism and narrowness. That's pretty clear. You know? This is kind of out of suttas. Those who cling to perceptions and views wander the world offending people. another translation, butting heads in the world, you know. Yeah, it's amazing how, you know, I mean, families and how much damage goes on with opinions and views, you know. So our world is really this capacity. It's just like seeing the nature of impermanence, seeing sometimes the kind of attachment or clinging to the body and the fabulous tool it is to understand. And to recognize that we walk around, you know, and the thing is, there. What are opinion views? Well, first of all, they are enculturated. So a lot of times from family systems, these have been passed on from generation to generation to generation. And they can have a tendency to separate people, communities out. And so in a way, our job is the first to see that we are, in a sense, prejudiced people of all types. And we have to, in a sense, kind of explore our prejudice, and how, as I said, some of them are just inherited views. And they weren't really, we didn't really think about them. They were just sort of passed on through schools and parents and systems, And here, I said the other day, kind of part of really waking up, it's really you understand that there isn't a solid self in some way, and that you have actually total faith in the Dharma. And they talked about it in the old texts as rites of not being hooked on rites and rituals. But I think cultural conditioning is a better translation, because that's sort of what happens, And so we have to have this incredible investigation towards, sexism, racism, and a lot of this stuff is enculturated. So, in a sense, there is this kind of deep questioning and untangling that needs to happen. Otherwise, we're just, again, we're walking around with, and these were passed on to us, colored glasses that actually are shading. It is, they aren't clear, they aren't seeing the, how it is or the truth. And so, and sometimes, unless conditions arise, we don't even know we're carrying them. So I just encourage you, because this is the crux of what is kind of separating us out, And I wonder if dolphins do that. Maybe they're smarter than us, but. But we are very strongly, doctrines and I don't know, religion and country and race and all that. There are such deep attachments, So I leave this with you. This is, this is kind of a quandary, and something you will in different places will have to come up against inside yourself, And a lot of it is sometimes fear and based on fear and prejudice. I like this is from Alan Watts. Beliefs cling. Faith lets go. Pretty good, huh? So I want to read along with that. I want to read this. This is from the Venerable Albert Einstein. A human being is a part of the whole, called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. Nobody is able to achieve this completely, but the striving for such achievement is in itself a part of the liberation and a foundation of a foundation for inner security. Albert Einstein. Not bad, huh? You know? So you're just gonna be whatever happens out there, you're gonna be working this, you know, I think a long time, you know. Because we're just scaredy cats, you know? And we're afraid of others, and we kind of, at one of the ways we created our defense system was through this, you know. So the job here, as far as Dharma goes, is when that contraction happens, that there, right there is a possibility towards freedom. That it was kind of, you know, whether we constructed it or is something just passed on to us, you know? So our, you know, our story is always somehow caught up in this. You know? It's almost like I was thinking, well, all these are really important, so I'm not going to say what's more important or not. Because ultimately, we're talking about kind of, you know, what is it? It's like being whole. We have to kind of know all these things. So, the fourth one here is views of ourself. You know, this wonderful thing called selfing. And it, again, causes a lot of, you know, it's again, I said there's relative and absolute. And the relative is actually caught up in the views and opinions and, you know, is disembodied. And it, because of the nature of the mind, which kind of is solidifying everything around you, doesn't see impermanence. That's what all those things do. So selfing, you know. So there's a piece of this practice. First of all, you know, there is a question whether the Buddha said there was a self or not a self, and that's where these two truths come in, where there's a relative and there's an absolute. And again, you know, I said the other night, our job is, first of all, we have to, you have to study the self to know the self. To know the self is to liberate all things. You follow that? You know. So we sit and you tell your, quote, story. You know. And usually it's just... kind of from last night, you kind of go out the window and you go off on this story. And it's all based in this belief that somehow I am a kind of a solid entity that... in a sense, you know, it's sort of, it's just the solid self itself, it imprisons, you know. And with imprisoned, it means we kind of, we're narrow and small. And don't realize that to loosen the grip on the self, and the control mechanism of it is a doorway. It's a doorway to peace. It's a doorway to freedom. So I got to indulge you here. and a little of Ajahn Sumedho, the venerable, one of my lineage people. He's so great. The practice of letting go is very effective for minds obsessed with compulsive thinking. You simplify your meditation practice down to just two words, letting go. Rather than trying to develop this practice and then develop that and achieve this and go into that and understand this and read the suttas and study the Abhidharma, then learn Pali and Sanskrit, then the Madhyamika and the Prajnaparamita, get ordained in the Hinayana, the Mahayana, the Vajrayana, write books, and become a world-renowned authority on Buddhism. Instead of becoming the world's expert on Buddhism and being invited to great international Buddhist conferences, just let go, let go, let go, let go. I did nothing but this for about 2 years. Every time I tried to understand or figure things out, I'd say, let go, let go, until the desire would fade out. So I'm making it very simple for you to save you from getting caught in incredible amounts of suffering. There's nothing more sorrowful than having to attend an international Buddhist conference. Some of you might have the desire to become the Buddha of the age, Maitreya, radiating love throughout the world. But instead, I suggest you being an earthworm, letting go of the desire to radiate love throughout the world. Just be an earthworm who knows only two words, let go, let go, let go. You see, ours is the lesser vehicle, the Hinayana. So we only have these simple poverty-stricken practices. The important thing is meditation practice is to be constant and resolve in the practice, determined to be enlightened. This is not to be conceited or foolish, but resolve, resolute. Even when the going gets rough, remember yourself of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and stay with it. Let go of despair, letting go of anguish, letting go of pain, of doubt, of everything that arises and passes that we habitually cling to identify with. Keep this letting go like a constant refrain in your mind, so it just pops up on its own, no matter where you are. Amen. So you have the tools. You know, it's pretty. In some ways, this is not so complicated. But it means that you have to, in some ways, you have to, you know, a lot of this is just simply remembering, you know, when you're in the middle of your world and you get caught up, or talking is so amazing, you know, talk about, it's kind of transcendent, you know, you just kind of go off, and the next thing you know, you maybe figured out the world, but you're really not here, you know. So, and this is saying, no, come on. If you can remember, it's wonderful, by the way, to learn to speak with part of your mind and your body. You know, it's really a fabulous tool. We're so, you know, we get caught in kind of the negativities of fixing things and gossip and you know, and the beliefs and the winning and losing. You heard about those, yeah. And so we have to understand how this works, you know. And then begin to see that, you know, one of the dangers in all this is that the selfing has two fundamentals, you know. And one of them is a thing, it's called inflation. I'm better than. And on the other side of that is deflation, which is I'm worse than, you know. And these are all identities. Now, what was interesting one of the suttas the Buddha talked about is that actually he said there's better than and worse than and the same as. So all of those are actually all types of selfing. You know, they aren't just in the suchness or the isness of things. They are, in a sense, using that dualistic identity as a means, you know. So I know one of the things, I know we all kind of run around with this, but to start to see that this is what we do, and then how can you, in a sense, you know, not get caught in inflation and not in deflation, and not try to compare about even being the same, you know, because those are all comparisons. And selfing is all about that, you know, about comparing. So that's the fourth one. The fifth, you know, which I wanted to get to, which is really this thing around awareness, and simple awareness. I think I kind of described last night a piece of it that I hope. Some of you may have understood pieces of it, you know. I wish I had better languaging skills, you know, but this is what you get, okay? And because it's really not easy to describe in that way. But it's also, you know, they talk about it as also the corruption of awareness, which I didn't understand what was meant by that for a long time. And I realized that this happens sometimes. I've come across that. You know, I used to go to some of Krishnamurti's stuff down in Ojai and the people around him and stuff. And I guess I'll be a little critical here. You know, and he was pretty upset the fact that not enough people got enlightened, you know, with his wondrous abilities to exemplify and kind of his language skills. But the thing was that a lot of the people there, they hadn't really done meditation because he wasn't so much into this kind of sitting down, and he kind of saw it as something that happened because you naturally could see what was happening, which, you know, a lot of people, they thought they did, but they actually were pretty much in their heads. You know, it was interesting. It was kind of a very intellectual rendition of awareness that was based towards, it was definitely based towards freedom. And sometimes people could get, you know, phrases or whatever that really worked. But at the same time, why was it, you know? And from my point of view, it could easily be worked as a head trip, but not necessarily a wholeness. And that's really was a lot of what we're trying to, you know. So there's an incremental process of learning that has to happen here, and it's very much, in essence, where that wholeness, and one of the pieces, the wholeness, it includes your heart, you know. So a lot of times the intellectual, very, sometimes kind of enlightened aspects and kind of satori's and all this stuff are fundamentally fine. But again, I'm not so sure because it ends up to be quite a head trip. And what we're really trying to do here is, and it's why one of the languages is simple, simple, simple awareness, and that we begin to see that we have the capacity when we're not caught, we kind of see the process, impermanence. We see that there is the capacity to kind of rest in the body as it is, not always comfortable, but as it is, and that we shade our experience through our views, opinions, and our comparing mind, which creates that inflation and deflation and same as. So suddenly we come to this place where we kind of have this hole, and a lot of it is really based on our ability to relax. So actually with tension, we can't actually, we can see through all these things, but if there's tension, then we're either leaning towards something or away from something. But someplace in the center, where there's a sense of ease and relaxation, and one begins to recognize that, again, going back to kind of last night, the there with the knowing. So that knowing, yes, at first it is quite, in some ways it's kind of dualistic. But just by beginning to attempt to, and particularly now you're going to go out in the big bad world, and this is I find a really, as a whole, although all these components have to kind of be there from, kind of the questioning around views and opinions and the kind of the comparison of with others and all this stuff with self, and the support we get from embodiment. And the kind of the view, the understanding, and I shouldn't say view, the understanding of the impermanence of it all, So with that kind of wholeness then, and enough ease and relaxation, then you begin to actually be able to take it into the world. It's not something that we just did here. It's something that, and you could say it's kind of a wakefulness. There's kind of, because it's not in time. It's not hooked to anything. It's not, in a sense, kind of caught in the impermanent world. So it has this basis of freeing you from actually whatever appears, because all of that is kind of in this realm that we deal with, and this is saying, oh, there's something that already is, it's already fully, in many ways, fully awake, but we can't. We can't grasp it. There's nothing. There's no way to hold it. It's only to be realized. And part of the process here is how can you begin to stabilize that kind of awareness that because it creates non-separateness and has always, and at first it seems quite dualistic and self-conscious, but as you kind of play with it, it becomes more and more a tool of freedom, not a tool of dualism, of me and it. So this is kind of your lot in some ways. So those are kind of the components I wanted to just kind of go over, because this is something I would like you to take with you. Try to remember the five as you kind of deal in the world. And then the next piece, so I really consider those wisdom factors, those five. And then there is, so that's one side of it. The other side of it is, it's this word compassion, And the thing is that at moments when you're not caught, and that sense, from Albert Einstein, that there, there is this kind of expansion of the universe that is not about us, It is simply this totality of awareness, And it is the middle way, because sometimes you can look at, the flowers, at some point they go the other way, and they're going to start kind of dying, And we're always wanting this kind of, oh, full bloom. But it's not the whole picture, So our practice ultimately, Ajahn Chah always said about he was attached. He had a favorite cup, and somebody asked him about his favorite cup, and he says, "Oh, I already see it broken. I already see it broken." And so, in that way, it may sound like a very kind of sobering thing in some ways. Oh, I look at things and I see the impermanence of it, that it's actually something in a world that's arising and disappearing, which is true, So with the understanding, if everything you look at that's a thing, all things, by the way, we're things, they have the nature to arise, kind of flower, and die, So when there's no longer the infatuation with exactly what is seen, but an understanding of the kind of the ephemeral nature of all things, then there's this possibility of compassion for everything, the trees, sequoias, and I don't know that, that last thousands of years, but they too arise and are there and die, or olive trees or whatever, There's nothing in the thing world that doesn't. So the kind of waking up, the awareness of that, it pangs your heart, So then suddenly, this question about action, it's no longer because I have my view about who this guy in some Oval Office is or something. It's really that I understand that all suffer, and all is conditioned. It all and all kind of arises, and that it. It can be there to, with the knowledge of this or the awareness of it, is there is empathy and suffering. So, within every person who you have ever had a problem with, they all have the same nature, And they all simply wanted to be happy. That was their intent, And no matter how they confused it or did what they did or didn't do what they did, it's still then part of this process, So ultimately, that we begin to see the world as impermanent, and that all beings, it's hard to say all beings are suffering, but all beings have the nature to arise and pass away. Therefore, what does that mean to me? And I hope that in some level then that sense of empathy or compassion arises just because they're all in the same process, you know. And then everybody is worthy of your love, you know. Even your enemy, you know. So I want to, I should read Stephen Levine, but I read this because I really like it. So you have to tolerate it. It's by David White. It's called The Well. Be thankful now for having arrived, for the sense of having drunk from a well, from remembering the long drought that preceded your arrival, and the years walking in a desert landscape of surfaces looking for a spring hidden from you so long that even wanting to find it now has gone from your mind until only you remembered the hard pilgrimage that brought you here, the thirst that caught in your throat, the taste of a world just missed, and the dry throat that came from a love you remembered but had never fully wanted for yourself, until finally, after years and years of making the long trek to get here, it was as if your whole achievement had become nothing but the thirst itself. But the miracle had come simply from allowing yourself to know that you had found it, that this time someone walking out into the clear air from far inside you had decided to walk past it, decided not to walk past it anymore. The miracle had come at the roadside, in the kneeling to drink, and the prayer you said, and the tears you shed, and the memory you held, and the realization that in this silence, you no longer had to keep your eyes and ears averted from that place that could save you. That you had been given the strength to let go of the thirsty, dust-laden pilgrim self that brought you here, walking with her bent back, her bowed head, and her careful explanations. No, the miracle had already happened. When you stood up, shook off the dust, and walked along the road from the well, out of the desert towards the mountain, as if already home again, as if you deserved what you loved all along, as if just remembering the taste of that clear, cool spring could lift up your face and set you free. So let's just sit for a moment.